welcome to the 22nd episode of the Hope Illuminated Podcast, your source for the stories, science, and strategy of suicide prevention, mental health promotion, and resiliency, where we live, learn, and work. I'm your host, Dr. Sally Spoker-Thomas, and I'm on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we're joined by international experts who inspire hope and offer real guidance. Welcome to the show. I'm so, so grateful that you're here. Today, we are joined by one of my favorite people in suicide prevention, Jennifer Battle, coming to us from Houston, and we're going to talk about crisis services, suicide crisis services in particular, what you need to know when you need a lifeline. So I'm going to talk a little bit about crisis services before I introduce my guest, because it's a really important topic. Each year, you know, we kind of divide up the year by focusing on upstream suicide prevention, kind of the things we need to do to bolster our protective factors. And then we turn into what we call midstream suicide prevention, which is how we catch problems that are emerging early and how do we link people to appropriate level of care before the problems are catastrophic. And then we also need to talk about what downstream suicide prevention looks like when we're in the throes of crises. And mental health crises tend to occur when our ability to cope is overwhelmed by either internal and or external stressors in our lives. And sometimes the inner stressors are related to a mental health condition, like a worsening depression or mania or psychosis or other kinds of illness-type features that are worsening for a number of reasons. Sometimes they're also related to external stressors, like a trauma that's happened to us or a relationship that's falling apart or an intense loss that we're experiencing. For whatever those reasons, and often there's many of them coming in contact in one place and time, people feel really unable to resolve their situation with the resources that they have, and they often feel really out of control and helpless. There's a lot of symptoms that can come into play when people are in this really intense place of being overwhelmed. Sometimes they're very agitated, can't sleep well, they can't think straight. And sometimes this becomes really uncomfortable, understandably. And so then people self-medicate sometimes by over-consuming drugs or alcohol or food or engaging in other types of risky behavior to kind of cope with those feelings. Others may pull away, shut down, and isolate. And still others might get somewhat irritable or angry and find themselves not acting like themselves and acting violently. For whatever the symptoms, the emotional intensity can become unbearable, unbearably painful. And sometimes when people are in that space, they think about suicide. And so we're very grateful that we have these crisis services that become our safety nets for folks that really need kind of a hand to hold during that moment to get them thinking straight again and to put a plan in place. As the crisis text line says, the goal of crisis services is really to help someone move from a hot to a cool moment. I love that description. People who answer the text line or answer the lifeline, they're all incredibly well-trained to help de-escalate these emotional crises when callers call in. You know, on a very short-term notice, people rarely have to wait very long to get this kind of support and really help them create a collaborative plan to stay safe for now. It's not only there for the person in crisis, but a lot of times it's the people who are surrounding the person in crisis that are reaching out to call. So it's there for everyone. And actually, you don't even have to be in the throes of the most intense crisis ever to reach out. People actually prefer if you call before that hit so that the plan doesn't have to be created kind of in that really intense moment. So today we're going to kind of explore the day in the life of a crisis support rock star, Jennifer Battle, and kind of her life and what she's doing down at the Harris Center in Houston. We're going to learn a lot more about how this works and what to expect and kind of what some of the trends are. We're going to talk about the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which currently has 159 call centers in 49 states, and we've seen a huge, huge surge in uptick of the volume to these call centers in just the last couple of years with all kinds of major public events like Logic's Grammy Award-winning song that actually puts the Lifeline number in the title. We also had 13 Reasons Why airing in 2017 and a number of high-profile celebrity suicides, Chris Cornell, Chester Bennington, Kate Spade, Anthony Bourdain. And now the media knows that often in the aftermath of these kinds of events to promote the crisis, National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. So the volume just surges. And what we used to see is it would come down after the crisis passed. But now we're seeing that it's going up and staying up, which is it's a challenge, but also a great opportunity for people to get connected. And then with the crisis text line, I'm going to say text connect. There's a bunch of words you can use to connect to the crisis text line. But today we're going to talk about text the word connect to 741-741. And since 2013, the crisis text line has had over 83 million messages exchanged. It's probably way more than that at this point, and where people are getting connected by text to a crisis counselor that engages them in active listening, collaborative problem solving to help them put together a plan to cope to get through this crisis. And all of the crisis counselors on the text line are volunteers, which is really remarkable and awesome. So now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest and my friend, Jennifer Battle. She is a proud social worker and also the program director of the Comprehensive Psychiatric Emergency System at the Harris Center for Mental Health in Houston. And she oversees this crisis line, which is one of the biggest in the country. It serves 34 Texas counties. It's huge, and it's also a leading innovator. She partners with both the Lifeline, the Suicide Prevention Lifeline, as well as the National Crisis Text Line. And she also is like the queen of collaboration. So she has developed these partnerships with the Houston Police Department, Houston Fire Department, Houston Emergency Communications Center to help set a crisis call diversion program. So we're going to hear more about that today. And it's an incredibly innovative and effective a way of helping people in crisis stay out of our emergency rooms and go instead to behavioral health options that are more appropriate for what they're dealing with. In addition to running this Harris Center, she's also a leader nationally in crisis. We have known each other through the American Association of Suicidology. We've also served on the board together at the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, the Advisory Steering Committee. And she's also currently the president of the board for the National Association of Crisis Organization Directors and the past co-chair of the Texas Suicide Prevention Council. So everyone, please give a warm welcome to my wonderful guest, Jennifer Battle. Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I am excited to be here with you, Sally. I love listening to your intro. Everything that you've said so far is just like, yes, yes, that's why I do this work. All the things.
Right. That's right. And I often think of you all like your angels behind the curtain. Like nobody really gets to see you. Nobody gets to really really know like what this work is all about. So I'm so glad that you're going to kind of come out behind the curtain and share a little bit about this so people have a better understanding and can feel really confident about these services. So let's start off with you. Tell me a little bit more about the past that led you to this work.
I often wonder about this. I teach a lot also at our local university here in the social work school at the University of Houston. And when I do my intros to my students, I always kind of just say, you know, I sort of landed in crisis work. My first work was in domestic violence and sexual assault crisis work. And I've just sort of stayed here ever since. Interestingly enough, I'm celebrating my 25th year of service in the crisis industry, which feels like
wow.
A lot to me since I feel like such a spring chicken. But I've been 15 years here at the Harris Center for Mental Health and IDD, and I look back and I just feel so grateful that crisis work ended up being where I landed. And I think that one of the reasons why it appeals to me so much and why I really stay with this type of work is because crisis can be anybody. It can be any of us at any given time in our life. And to be able to do work that has the capacity to touch every single person that I speak to or connect with or myself or my family, is such a gift. And I, you know, we talk to people every day in our various crisis services programs who don't ever think that they're going to need us, right? Because nobody plans for a crisis.
Right.
But we all need support for something eventually. And so it's such a gift to be able to be behind the scenes and behind the phones and in a place where that's so accessible that anybody that has access to a phone can access us. It doesn't matter if you're rural or urban or you're frontier or you're suburban. If you have access to a phone, which most people do in our society in some way or another, we're here for you. And that's another wonderful piece of this work is I'm also, as a social worker, pretty connected into the social justice movement and being able to look at programming that doesn't discriminate, that is available to everyone, regardless of cost or ability to pay, is, again, just I feel so fortunate to be in this particular field, to be able to do that for the community.
Oh, that's so awesome. And you're right. Our crisis can happen to anyone, really, at any time. You really can't get through this life without at some point being brought to your knees by an overwhelming challenge. And so I think it's really important for all of us and all of our families to consider that and put a plan in place, you know these resources and also put a plan in place before the crisis hits so that we're better prepared. I love your mindset of gratitude. It's so beautiful, and it is so important for people in the work that you do and also other forms of mental health service to take a deep breath when you're faced with something that seems really intense, and instead of coming into it with anxiety and panic and, oh, my God, I have to deal with a crisis, you know, that kind of attitude. When I coach my mental health providers, I said, stand back, take a deep breath, and say, you know what, today I get to walk alongside someone in their darkest moment, and I get to help them, and that is an honor. And you will go into that interaction with what you just described, this beautiful sense of this being a gift, and that gratitude will spill over into that relationship. So thanks for modeling that for us. Tell us a little bit more about kind of the crisis center, how it works, what it looks like. What's a day in the life of a crisis counselor feel like?
That is a great question. So sort of a funny thing is, you know, if you've seen one crisis center, you've seen one crisis center. Right? Like, we're all a little bit different, but that's what makes us so interesting and fun. So as you mentioned before, when you talk specifically about centers that are partnering with the Lifeline, you know, that's 159 different crisis centers all across the United States, which is really exciting. And then, of course, there's also crisis centers all over the world. And so we do share quite a few things in common. And so the things that we share in common are that we all have people, either volunteers or paid staff or a combination of the two, who show up and show out every single day. The majority of us in these crisis centers are here 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. We work in office buildings. We work in strip centers. We work in old houses. We work all over the place. The history of the crisis center, crisis lines, is really interesting. They started, you know, in people's basements. Out in California, there are a couple of crisis lines that started up at the same time that, you know, people just got some phones and they got some Rolodexes with some, you know, numbers for different support services, and they just plugged in and they made it happen. And it's not so dissimilar these days. My particular center is part of a larger system of care. So my center is part of a large, what they call, local mental health authority. And so we have all kinds of programs at my agency. We have outpatient mental health clinics for adults and children. We have services for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We have mobile crisis teams that go out into the community. We have walk-in emergency rooms for folks. We have programs and services inside of our jail system. We have programs to try to prevent people from getting inside of the jail system, working directly with courts. So we have this huge sort of continuum of care, and our crisis line is sort of plopped right in the middle of all that. And so our crisis line is really what we would consider the access point for people trying to figure out what to do next. As we talked about before, many times people aren't prepared for their crisis, even if they thought they might be. You know, the definition of crisis, Sally, that you so well pointed out earlier was sort of like knowing how to cope and knowing how to, you know, knowing what's out there and how to react to different situations. And with a crisis, we often, it doesn't mean that we don't have coping skills and we don't have resources. It just means that the situation that's presented itself to us right now is beyond our current capacity. We don't know what to do. It doesn't mean we don't know what to do in other situations. It just means right now, today, right here, I'm not sure how to move forward. And again, that's the beauty of the crisis line. So in our community, people can call in to this number. It's available 24/7. You can call in through a 1-800 toll-free number. You can call in through our 10-digit number. And what you have is a person who answers that phone in a warm and caring manner, who then will hear your story, invite you to tell your story, and then based on their years of knowledge and experience and expertise and training, since they are not in a crisis situation, they have the ability to really listen and sort of parse out some next steps, immediate next steps for this person. And so sometimes it's as simple as, like you mentioned, you know, take a breath, right? You know, like just take a breath, let's breathe together for a moment, right? And just calm ourselves. And that's important to say to people, because even though intuitively we all think that in the middle of a crisis situation, sometimes that breath gets lost. And so we have the ability to help physically calm people by helping people sit down. If they're standing, we encourage people to sit. If they're hyperventilating, we encourage them to breathe. If they're crying, we let them cry. If they're screaming, we'll let them yell, but then also encourage them to, you know, take some breaths so they can calm down. And sometimes we just sit there on the phone with them for a few minutes while they do that. And that can be the first step, right?
That's
it's pretty powerful. Active. Just that being there.
I know. And I it was so striking to me. So I visited your call center and a couple of others around the country. And I want you to describe, like, if someone were walking in there on a tour, what they would see, because, you know, here all these really intense conversations are happening on the phone, but the whole atmosphere for all of your staff is all about calm. Can you tell me a little bit, describe the scene for us?
It is all about calm. Our space, you walk in. If you can visualize a call center, it probably looks like what you are thinking about. You know, it's a big open room with cubicles, but they're low-set cubicles, so the team can always see each other and support each other and hear each other, which I know sounds counterintuitive because you think, oh, it's a call center, it must be very loud. Actually, it is not. The way that we have it designed is so that you can still be very insulated in your space on a call, while your neighbor next door is also on a call as well. And you can't hear each other necessarily, but if you are one of our crisis line specialists who's not on a call, you can definitely still be alert and available and paying attention to what's going on in the room. So if there's a need to sort of jump in and provide support to one of your colleagues, that you can. So it's this kind of big open room with all these cubicles, and then in the middle of the room we have some stations that are specific for what we call our supervisors on duty, which are exactly what it sounds like, the supervisors who are, again, also there just to be able to provide support and whatever is needed to help the team. And they love to keep the lights down, so it always sort of is in a calm and not brash environment. The team, we have windows all around the call center, so and we're on sort of a mid-high floor, so our view is of a golf course across the street, which is really nice. So there's some greenery outside. And it tends to be pretty quiet even when everybody is on calls, which feels very good. And we do keep it pretty colorful. We have a lot of fun things that are going on in the room. We always, sort of my strategy is that the work is intense, so the play should be pretty fun too. So in between calls, there's always something going on in the room. We have puzzle stations up where people can, you know, work on a puzzle if they want to. We're big fans of that meditative coloring. So we have coloring books and pencils all around. There's pretty good chance that there's going to be a table with snacks or treats on it any given day. We have lots of celebrations for pretty much almost anything. We like to support the team and celebrate the team. We have a really colorful thank you board that has colorful magnets of language and words that callers might use when they call back in of their own volition and tell us thank you or tell a particular phone counselor thank you. And we fill that board up, and then when it's full, we take those magnets off and we give it to the crisis line specialist who was recognized so that they can put it on their personal cubicle or their station as a reminder of the good work that they're doing. We have another big, bright bulletin board that's called the shout-out board. And so individuals on the team can give each other shout-outs for something that they felt was sort of above and beyond. The supervisors can give folks shout-outs again for something that they felt was above and beyond. We take those down at the first of every month. I read through them. We log them so we can kind of keep track of those. And then we personally hand those out to each one of the crisis line specialist who receives one, and then they hang those up at their stations as, again, a reminder of just doing great work. We also have a quiet room. Some places call it a tranquility room or a rest room or a self-care room, and so we call ours the quiet room. As you can imagine, the work can be very intense. And there are some times where you just kind of, instead of being in the big group open space, you may just need to be in a room and shut the door for a few minutes. And so if somebody was on a particularly challenging call, they can check in with the supervisor, of course, and then they can go into the quiet room. We have a rocking chair in there. We have yoga ball and stretch, you know, bulletin boards. And again, they keep the lights pretty dim in there with just a lamp. And we have one of those kind of sand zen things that you can rake across on a coffee table and just give people a few minutes just to decompress. And then they can come back out and jump right back on the phones. So it's a really interesting space in that it's always busy and there's always a lot going on, but you don't ever feel that way. It was designed specifically to feel, like you said, calm and organized, I guess, very organized and relaxed and easy for the team to find what they need quickly and efficiently, easy for them to support each other, easy for the supervisors to provide support when needed.
That sounds awesome. Sounds like a really great place to work. I think what you described here are practices that many workplaces could adopt to help their teams feel appreciated and calm as well. What percentage of your team are paid staff versus volunteers? And if somebody is interested perhaps in volunteering for a crisis center, what might they do?
Great question. Just coming back to your first comment that you made, we actually use trauma-informed care practices and principles in the design of our crisis line program. Mm. So we've taken some of those trauma-informed care principles and made the ones that were specific to departments or organizations, we use that actively in our design, which I think is really important. So any organization can do that, and I'll send you some links that you can put up on your website for that. Nice. Around our team, my team is all paid staff, and my team here at the Harris Center is all paid staff because that's what's required per our contract with our funder. So that is not the case in all places. Like I mentioned before, you've seen one crisis center. Mm-hmm. So there are plenty of crisis centers across the United States who use only volunteers and then have, you know, sort of the only paid staff that they have or the people that sort of, you know, run the numbers and do the program level organizing and development components. And there are also a growing number of crisis centers who use what we would consider sort of hybrid staff, right? So they have majority volunteers, but then maybe they have in some paid staff for those sort of difficult-to-fill shifts. Sometimes those overnight shifts can be a booger. So being able to have some paid staff round those out but be able to have volunteers for the rest of the time is really great. The thing that's real interesting about this is that there's been some research done that shows that there really isn't a difference in the quality of care per somebody being a paid staff or a volunteer staff person. So I think that's really important. So if you were in your local community and you said, oh, well, this is a volunteer answering this line, can I trust that they're doing a good job because they're not a paid, you know, clinician or what have you? The answer is absolutely you can. So, mm-hmm. And so when you look at what the research tells us is that the main qualities that somebody needs in order to be an effective crisis caregiver over the phone are empathy-based, right? So people who actually care about other folks, people who have what we call good contact, which means that we actually, you know, sound like we want to be here and that we sound like mm-hmm. we want to receive your story, that we are patient, that we have good collaborative care, which means that this is not an advice line. We don't have a list of these are the 10 things that we're going to tell every person that calls us to do. That's mm-hmm. absolutely not what happens, right? It's about collaboration. It's about listening to each person that calls, listening to their story, and then helping them determine what it is that they need. That's part of that crisis response, right? What is it that they feel like they need right now to be able to move forward? And then helping them figure that out and take some steps toward that. None of those things require somebody to get a paycheck to do it. None of those things mm-hmm. require that somebody have specific letters behind their name to do that. You know, in fact, again, there's other research out there that really says, you know, you can't make somebody be an empathetic person. There's no training class I can send you to have you become an empathetic human being. You sort of, you know, come with a prepackaged model of being of empathy, right? So what we can do is help you hone your skills, right? We can help you be able to figure out how to use those empathetic skills and background and active listening in a way that's meaningful for somebody, but I can't turn you into somebody who's empathetic. So empathy comes regardless of, again, paycheck status. In my agency, though, because we're part of a larger mental health system, there was not a lot of space for conversation around volunteers versus paid staff. It's sort of everybody at the agency is paid staff. And my crisis line specialists all have a degree in some sort of human service-based background, social work, psychology, something along those lines. But in addition to that, they're still going to get several hundred hours of training before they go onto the phones. And for any of these centers that we've talked about, any of the, you know, 159 Lifeline centers, any of the 100-some-odd centers or folks that are participate in the National Association of Crisis Organization Directors or Contact USA, any of these sort of organizations that really work to help crisis centers be the best that they can be, there are accreditation standards. So in order to be a Lifeline center, you have to have an accreditation by one of these national organizations that says you have met some minimum guidelines for the level of professional work that you do there. So your training program has to be strong and solid, and it has to cover these items. Your vetting of your crisis responders needs to look a certain way. Your quality assurance program, A, you need to have a quality assurance program. B, your quality assurance program needs to meet certain guidelines and specifications. So there's lots of different components out there to really protect the general public and make sure that those of us that are doing this very important and very meaningful work are skilled and ready to do that and are providing effective feedback to the people that do the work with us.
And I would argue that the training that the call takers receive is often far more continuous, rigorous, and many more hours than what most mental health professionals get around suicide in particular. And also the quality assurance. Like most mental health professionals they're just doing their own thing, you know, in their own private practice. No one's really watching over their shoulder to make sure that they're getting that continuing education, that they're up to standards of care and state-of-the-art treatments, and that they're documenting in a certain way. Nobody's doing that for them, but to uphold your accreditation standards, that is part of the day-to-day routine. So you're in good hands when it comes to reach out to our accredited call centers. I just want to circle back, because I know that sometimes, especially people who have had their own experiences with suicide, suicide loss, or their own experiences with suicide intensity, sometimes they turn to make meaning out of that by volunteering. So if somebody does want to volunteer, where is the easiest place for them to contribute? Because it really can be helpful for the helper, and also their life experience can also sometimes help that connection, either for the crisis text line or for the lifeline.
Absolutely. Well, I think the best thing to do, what we'll do is make sure we put a link up on your page about the different locations for all of the Lifeline centers. Like I said, there's 159 of them, and there's an interactive component on the Lifeline website where you can look at the specific state and you can see where the closest Lifeline center is to you. So that would typically include going to a brick and mortar location and, you know, signing up there to actually work in their crisis programming. And then you mentioned Crisis Text Line before, which is also a really kind of neat evolution in the services that we provide, in that you don't necessarily, there is no brick and mortar, it's all online, so it doesn't matter where you are, and you can go onto the Crisis Text Line website and apply to be a volunteer there, and all of their training is online, and all of their actual volunteer work is online. Also, though, many of those centers that I mentioned before that are with Lifeline, they do offer, many of them offer text, many of them offer chat. Many of them have speakers bureaus, so if you are somebody who has lived experience or really feels called to the mission, there's some other work that you can do there. Sometimes working on the crisis line or crisis text or chat can feel maybe not what people are ready to do yet, but being involved in other components of the crisis center can be very valuable. You know, everybody needs, you know, the worker bees, right? We all need people to help make the programs grow and thrive. So there's many of those crisis centers, well, all of those crisis centers are funded locally, right? There is no funding available for people to answer National Suicide Prevention Lifeline calls from the federal government. It's something that's funded completely at the local level. So many of these centers are going to have your standard fundraisers, right? Your galas, your walks, your runs, your bowl-a-thons. So they're always looking for people to come in and help. So I would say check out that the Lifeline website. And then also just Google your community, crisis center in my community, because there's, you know, hundreds of crisis centers that are not affiliated with Lifeline but are still doing fantastic work in local communities. So you can just say, you know, where's the closest crisis center to me? And give them a call. Look at them online. Check out their website. See what does it take to be a volunteer there and do it. Even those of us that don't use volunteers but have paid staff, we still need support. I had a friend of mine, I had made a post on social media the other day about, you know, how I thought it was so cool that my staff does these puzzles, you know, in between calls, mm-hmm. just to sort of. And she showed up here the other day with like 6 boxes of puzzles that she wanted to give my team because she just, awesome. She was called to do that. You know, so it's just, you know, it's really, it's great. So, people can always find a way to give back and to be supportive.
Great. All right. Well, let's go back. Let's go back to the call center. We've got the dimly lit open space cubicles. We can envision it, and we can kind of imagine what it would be like for someone to call in. There's warm caring. There's listening to the stories, taking breaths, getting ourselves calm, listening, empowering them to come up with some of their own coping strategies, reminding them of their own resilience. What happens next, and what happens when, you know, that we come to a place of, you know, collaboratively feeling like we're going to be safe for now? What happens when things spiral out of control and we need to take another step? And then what happens after that? Can you walk us through the next steps of the call?
Sure, I can. Well, the first thing I want to reiterate is that, again, part of that collaborative problem solving is going to include a lot of safety planning. So safety planning is probably one of the biggest skill sets that we can provide for somebody who's experiencing a crisis or for a loved one who's calling on behalf of someone that they know who's experiencing a crisis. So that safe for now component is really, really important. But we also want to help people be safe for later. So having a good safety plan in place is really helpful. And so at our center, we use the Barbara Stanley VA model of safety planning, which is a 6-point safety plan, which we can do over the phone with people. Back in the old days, we actually used to, you know, type them up and snail mail them out to people so that they could put them up on their refrigerators or what have you. Nowadays, there's, you know, a handful of very cool kind of apps that allow people to have their safety plan with them anywhere they go. But usually you want to sit down and do that with somebody. As you mentioned before, you know, any therapist, in my opinion, worth their salt, should be doing safety planning with anybody that comes in for services with them. But as we're still in growth in the community to make that happen, you definitely should get that when you call a crisis line. So what we might say is, do you have a safety plan? And if the person says yes, then we'll kind of say, well, where are you on that safety plan? The crisis line is usually step four on that, which means that they've done several other things that didn't work for them. And so we want to find out where they are in their safety plan. And then what's next? Who are the other folks that they have listed that they typically would want to know that they're experiencing this crisis? And again, when you're in a crisis, you may forget that you have done all this work. And that's okay. And that's our job, is to kind of help you remember that you may have done a lot of this work prior to your crisis, and that we're here to help you to remember that. So for the most part, the majority of the people that we serve, we can help de-escalate. We can help them with their current safety plan. We can help them put a new safety plan together to be safe for now. And then we can, in a center like mine that has lots of access to a crisis continuity of care, we can get people connected. We have mobile crisis teams. We have walk-in emergency rooms. We have all kinds of options. So typically we can get people somewhere voluntarily, do whatever it is that they need to do to get that help and support. So there are rare occasions when we are unable to use our skills. We'll use our skills, but our skills are not helping the person. And we've done everything that we can to try to help somebody make a decision in the midst of their crisis to be safe, and they are not there. And so, but they have called us, and they did ask for help. So we're going to help them, even if they're not able to vocalize their want for that help at this particular moment. And so, again, I want to emphasize that this is very rare, because this is something that a lot of people are worried about and can also be a barrier for people calling into crisis lines, because they think that the moment that they say the word suicide, somebody is going to freak out and call the cops on them. I can guarantee you that that is not the goal of most crisis lines, definitely not ours. And so we actually, anytime we send law enforcement response to a call, our supervisors review that case. We do a case review the next day because we are so careful and so conscientious about the utilization of law enforcement, especially when working with somebody with a severe and chronic mental health issue, that we take it very seriously. But when we need it, and when the caller needs it, we're grateful to have it. So if that is the case and we cannot help somebody de-escalate, they have a plan, a specific plan of how they want to kill themselves and access to the means to carry out that plan. And they are alone and they don't have any other support systems, and they have told us that they are planning to act on that plan with the means that they have available within the next hour. Those would be the flow chart that we would use to determine whether or not we're going to activate a rescue So it does happen from time to time, but it's definitely not a regular thing. But then those thank you calls I mentioned earlier, those ones where we have hanging up, you know, in the crisis line, some of those are from people who were pretty mad at us at first when we sent out rescue, but then later call back and tell us thank you and appreciate that we were here and that we made that difficult call to try to get them the help that they needed. So we're glad to be able to do that.
Yeah, I would describe it as like a heart attack in front of you. You know, the person is so imminently close to death that at that moment you kind of have to take it into that, you know, health emergency realm of things. You know, you do everything you can to try to avoid that space. Thank you for walking us through that. Share with me a little bit more, too, about kind of the follow-up services and also the diversion services. You talked a little bit about, you know, rather than taking them to kind of the general hospital ER, which isn't always the best place for people in the middle of an emotional crisis, what are some of the diversion things that you've partnered with your local first responders to put together?
Yeah, great question. So we do a ton of follow-up calls. We probably do almost as many follow-up calls, outbound calls, as we take inbound calls because some cases require multiple follow-ups, right? Because if we're talking to somebody who has shared with us that they are feeling suicidal, but they do have a safety plan or they allowed us to do a safety plan with them, that we're trying to engage support services in their community, you know, a friend or a family member or someone that's going to come over to the house and try to help them out, drive them to drive them somewhere to get help to a clinic or what have you. Well, we can't just be like, okay, well, good job, thanks for that, good luck, you know, and hang up. You know, our responsibility is to, you know, stick out the case with them. You know, we started this with you, and we want to make sure that you get to the next level of care so that we can confirm that you got what you needed in order to get past this particular moment. I love that you mentioned the crisis text line, hot to cool. Hot to cool is always a goal, but I'll take hot to lukewarm, right? Like, you know, if that's what I can get, you know, then we're happy for it. But you know, so our job is to follow up. You know, on those difficult calls, cases that I mentioned before, if we do need to call law enforcement out, then, you know, we're going to follow up and talk with even the dispatch center to make sure that the person, you know, was picked up and where they were taken so that we can confirm that they got where they needed to go. That's really important to us. And so sometimes it's not even that those really imminent risk situations, but it could be somebody who, you know, is just really struggling and maybe we ask them to take some action steps on their own, at their home, could be, something really simple, like, you know, when was the last time that you took a shower? You know, or when was the last time you ate something? And so we may ask somebody to do some basic kind of self-care activities like that. And then we'll tell them, you know, hey, so we're going to call you back in, you know, 15 or 20 minutes to check on you and see how that worked and see how you're feeling. And so those are really important parts of the work that we do that often get overlooked because everybody wants to always say, how many calls do you take? And I'm like, well, it's not just the calls that we take, but it's also the calls that we make. Right. So it's these follow through calls and these follow up calls, you know, and there's some really fantastic research out there that's been done with crisis centers that look at the impact of these follow up calls. And there's just like a tremendous number of people who've said somewhere, you know, up in the range of, you know, 79% of people that say when they get that getting these follow up calls from their local crisis center after that initial call has been a part of their decision to decide not to move forward with their suicide attempt. I mean, and if that's not powerful, like, I don't know.
That's exactly what we're doing this for. That's exactly what we're striving for. Right. You're talking about, is this Matt Gould's research out of Columbia University?
Dr. Gould, Madeline Gould's research. And you know, and so that's a really powerful piece. And, you know, so we have an entire training curriculum that we have around the importance of those follow-up calls. And we have an entire program policies and procedures in place to make sure that once that follow-up call has been offered, it gets made and completed, right? Because we don't ever want to offer a follow-up call knowing what we know about the data around how impactful that can be for somebody, and then B, not do it, right? Because then we become part of that system that doesn't care, right? So if I offered you this follow-up call and then I didn't make it, then that can feed into someone else's story around, well, see, nobody really cares, and I was right to think that I'm alone. And so that's the exact opposite of where crisis centers really want to be. So that's that piece. And the diversion piece is really exciting. So there's been a lot of, again, research that's been done on the national level with crisis centers, specifically those that are partnering with emergency departments and looking at, you know, what can we do to try to prevent people from going to those emergency departments in the first place by having good ongoing care. But once people have made it to those emergency departments, what are we doing to try to make sure that there's enough follow-up there so that those folks get mental health care or services so they don't end up back at those emergency departments? And so there's a lot of really great work that's going around in the country on that. Here in Houston, we've taken a little bit of a different strategy on this, and we have a very, very significant ongoing partnership and relationship with our law enforcement, both the Houston Police Department and the Harris County Sheriff's Office. So those relationships and those partnerships are responsible for a great number of really kind of innovative and interesting things, including our 24-hour walk-in emergency room that was created specifically back in the late 90s so that officers had an option instead of jail and emergency departments, right? Because, again, sort of, in other parts of the country, this is still going on, but in here in Houston, we consider it back in the old days, where if there was nowhere else to take a person that was experiencing a suicidal crisis or a mental health crisis, the goal of the officer, the goal of law enforcement is for that person to be safe. And so there may have been no option in that community for eyes on to this person during their crisis except to take them to jail, which so I know.
Aiming.
Right. But we fuss at the law enforcement all the time because we think they were doing that to be mean. But the reality is that they were doing it because that's the only place that they had available for someone to stay safe.
Exactly.
And so I think that that's an important distinction. So as a community, as a system of care, doing something like what we did in Houston was really, really important. And that was all of these different organizations coming together, the support organizations, the family organizations like NAMI, National Association for Mental Illness, those groups coming together, advocacy organizations saying, we don't like this. This is not what needs to happen. That's not the right environment. And emergency departments are already overloaded, right? So what do we need to do? So one of the things that we did was build this 24-hour walk-in emergency room. And so then we built a series of other programs, including we have officers who ride alongside with a licensed clinician. So they ride in the car together. They respond to scenes together of mental health crisis situations, including suicidal crisis situations, with the goal of trying to just de-escalate the situation on scene. Right, not have to take anybody anywhere, but then that clinician can make that clinician who's connected to our organization can schedule that person for a follow-up visit, right? We can maybe send a mobile crisis team out the next day or get somebody connected to ongoing care. So that's a beautiful, amazing thing. And so along that, those years and years of investment in those type of services, we have a homeless outreach team, which is an officer and a case worker that goes out into the homeless encampments. So all kinds of things. So when we looked at sort of this jail diversion model, which says what can we do to keep people with mental health issues out of the jails and into treatment, one day we were having sort of this brainstorming conversation and we went, well, you know, it's all well and good, but what we really need to do is just kind of like prevent officers from getting onto the scenes to the best of our ability, right? Like, what can we do to try to just say, can we just handle these situations in-house with mental health specialists as opposed to law enforcement having to deal with mental health issues? So we pitched an idea to actually co-locate some of our crisis line specialists inside of the Houston Police Department's dispatch center, which is, I'm sure your listeners can imagine, you know, Houston is the fourth cuspy third largest city in the country. So our dispatch center takes, you know, thousands and thousands of calls, right, a day. So we ran all kinds of interesting data, and we said what percentage of these calls were cleared what police call information only, which means an officer spent time going to a scene that was designated to have some sort of mental health concern and then just kind of left. Like they didn't do anything. Well, which is good. You know, I'd rather have them leave than pick somebody up
right.
and take jail. But at the same time, you still had somebody who felt like their situation was serious enough that they felt like their only option was to call 911 for help. But it's not the law enforcement responder's job to provide mental health assistance. So, you know, they can go to the scene. If the person is de-escalated, then there's not really anything within their law enforcement range that they can do. So my team is now there. This is the first co-located program in the country. It's pretty exciting. They've been there almost 3 years now. They clear, probably upwards of maybe 15 to 20 diversion cases a day out of the Houston Emergency Communications Center where the dispatch is, which means that those are calls that law enforcement doesn't have to go out to, and we can get people connected to ongoing care, which is really exciting. And it was such a success with the police department that the Houston Fire Department also requested to work directly with us. So our team can also take calls that come in through the fire department 911 system for people who are not at risk, of course, of any sort of imminent health concern, but they're calling around a mental health related issue, and we can help divert those calls as well. And so we're saving, it's not a specific cost savings because there's no less firefighters and there's no less police officers, but we're diverting those resources, right? So those officers that may have been responding to a mental health call can really respond to a robbery in progress, or the fire department EMS, instead of responding to somebody who, you know, has a question about their medication, they can respond to the person who's actually having that heart attack. So we're diverting almost $1 million worth of those emergency first responder services back into that emergency first responder system a year. So that's been very successful and very exciting. And again, we were only really able to do that because of the really great reputation that our crisis line had for all these years, as well as our ongoing partnerships and relationships with those stakeholders in our first responder community. Pretty cool stuff.
I love it. I love it. Love it. Love it. That's like such a win-win-win-win. And you know, I think you can have the most compassionate, the most patient law enforcement officer, but when they roll up on scene, you know, with lights and badges, and they are a symbol of authority that can be intimidating to people. And so for them to say, you know what, here's my lane, I'm working on trying to control crime. You know, here's your lane, you help people in distress. Why don't you, you know, take the first pass at these calls that really need that kind of, you know, that's your role. That's what you do as that first response to their crisis. And it's just such a win-win-win all around. So hopefully that's a model that's going to continue to spread across the country. As we're coming into the close here, I wonder if you have any kind of last-minute takeaways for our folks, things that you want them to know about crisis services that maybe help them better understand.
Absolutely. Well, the first thing is that regardless of the situation that you may be experiencing, one of the core components of a crisis line is non-judgmental, right? So there is no shame in our game. So, you know, please feel that you can call and talk to us about anything that you need to, and that we're not going to judge you, and there's definitely not going to be any shame there, and that even though your situation probably feels very unique to you and you feel like you're the only person that's ever experienced it, there's a high likelihood that we've talked to somebody who may have had a similar situation. Nobody's situation is ever the same, but that we know how to listen to you and we know how to support you. So that's really important. The other thing is, you know, we've mentioned these Lifeline calls a lot, and we've mentioned these different crisis centers all over the country. Please remember that your crisis center is a local center. Your crisis center needs local resources. So if this moves you, if this conversation is important to you, reach out to that local crisis center and figure out how they operate, where their funding comes from. I guarantee we just got done with the crisis conference. That was over 100 people from different crisis centers all throughout the country. And at one point, we asked people, raise your hand if you have all the funding that you need to effectively operate your services. And not one single person in the room raised their hand, which, of course, we knew they wouldn't. But that's really important because we are the front lines, right? We're here and we're doing all this work, and we don't have the resources that we need in order to do it. And we would love more support there. So if you can volunteer, you know, if you can donate, if you can help people connect to their legislators or their advocates in their communities, we would love that.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much. Let me do a quick recap here. I got about 8 pages of notes, so buckle up. No. Yeah, so this is Jennifer Battle from the Harris Center in Houston, and we kind of opened up the conversation, you know, with my words of it, like, these are the angels behind the curtain of taking these crisis calls for us and our family members and the people we love on their worst day. And how much I appreciate the mindset of gratitude that's coming from Jennifer as the leader of this Harris Center. And really, that is it is absolutely essential to have that framework in working in this, because you're going to show up in a much better space, but you're also going to be able to take care of your own self as well as you're coming into this from a sense of honor. I love your also position of the crisis centers being part of social justice services that don't discriminate. Most people have phones and can access this anytime, any place. And also the humble start of where they began with volunteers in basements. And I feel like that air of unconditional giving and support, no matter what, is a thread that has continued throughout the culture of crisis centers today. And then we kind of walked through kind of the day in the life of a crisis center and what happens on these calls. And hopefully you got to get a sense of these are really places about being calm and centered so that we can help people be able to tell their story, take a breath, kind of empower them to touch back on the touchstones of the pieces of their life where they've been there before and remember their support systems, remember their coping skills. And if they can't, we can help. Help them create them during that moment and really de-escalate that situation. This is also a place that's very much informed by the research that we have around trauma. And so everything that we can do to help people kind of connect those dots, but also the things that we know help with people in trauma can also help them de-escalate in this moment. We talked about the importance of volunteer opportunities and how sometimes that's a great meaning-making process for people who are coming through their own lived experience. Sometimes it's a great professional development opportunity for people who are considering going into mental health services, and there's lots of options there. There's I'll put this all in the show notes. You can click on the Lifeline Center closest to you, or you can volunteer for the Crisis Text Line, which is not connected to any kind of local building. You can do that anywhere. And really, you underscored for me the importance that it's not just answering the calls or the texts that is the only volunteer services needed. There's all types of volunteers that are needed. So if you don't feel quite ready to take those crisis calls, there's other ways we can put you to work, and we need you. We talked about the very high level of standards that crisis centers have, the hours of training, the quality assurance, the constant case review to make sure that everybody's getting the best care possible, and how that is really, really kind of iterating and improving our ability to care for people again and again. So the crisis centers are really leading the way in many areas on how we better serve folks. And I'll put up some of those safety planning tools that you mentioned because those are also things that people can access on their own. I'll put up some of the research that you talked about in terms of that importance of follow-up And I love that you're doing that, not just with the person who called in, but also with dispatch. That kind of follow-up contact tells that person, you know, you matter. You matter to us. We want to make sure it's working out for you. We care about you. We want to make sure that you got what you needed. And all of those messages, just the fact that you reached out to do that, is healing and super powerful. And it's something that also we can do with other people that we care about. You know, once you've connected with someone around a crisis, just reach out back out to them and say, hey, I'm thinking about you. I'm wondering how things are going. It means so much. I love your program about the Diversion First Responder Partnerships. I know that when I was out there visiting you in Houston a couple of years ago, it was just getting off the ground, and already it had such promise. So super excited to see that it's moving forward on all fronts. Because we really need to keep our people who are experiencing mental health crises out of jails and really as much as we can out of those very, very busy, harried ERs, which are really not equipped to handle psychiatric emergencies in the same way that they're equipped to handle heart attacks and you know, car crash injuries and so forth. So in conclusion, three takeaways are really about non-judgmental, no shame in the game. So please call if you're thinking about needing support, call. Your crisis center is local and needs you, so volunteer, donate, get your legislators involved, and really lean into this resource because they do care. So I love this interview. Thank you so much, Jennifer. Where can people find you if they want to connect with you?
You can find me. I can give you my email. It's jennifer.battle@theharriscenter.org. Or on Twitter @battle4justice, battle for justice.
Oh, I love that Twitter handle, battle for justice. You're so good. All right, so we'll put up all these show notes. And so in closing, open your heart, challenge your thinking, and take action to save lives. Together, we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living.
Grab a hold of big breakfast flavor at Hardee's. Try two breakfast sliders for just $2.99. Get Applewood smoked bacon or freshly grilled sausage with fluffy eggs and golden melty cheese all on a toasty little bun. Good morning, start at Hardee's. Available now for a limited time at participating restaurants. Tax not included. Grab a hold of big breakfast flavor at Hardee's. Try two breakfast sliders for just $2.99. Get Applewood smoked bacon or freshly grilled sausage with fluffy eggs and golden melty cheese all on a toasty little bun. Good morning, start at Hardee's. Available now for a limited time at participating restaurants. Tax not included.